cash rules everything around me. Queen, get the money, dollar dollar bill, yo.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome to the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, recording on Tuesday, June the 6th. You'll hear this on Wednesday, June the 7th and beyond. I am joined, first of all, I'm Vlad Sedler, in case you don't know me, at RotoGood on Twitter. Today, I'm joined by a very prominent baseball writer, an author, award-winning journalist. He's a former beat writer for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. He wrote a book and co-wrote one as well. The one he co-wrote was with Ben Lindbergh. It's called The MVP Machine. He wrote that a few years ago. And then a few years prior to that, in 2015, he wrote a book called Big Data Baseball, Math, Miracles, and the End of a 20-Year Losing Streak about that Pittsburgh Pirates franchise. You've seen him on MLB Network, ESPN, FanGraphs, in Grantland from back in the day, if you remember that site. Currently an MLB writer for The Score, which happens to be the app that I use for my box scores. I check it every day. And also a sneaky good NFBC player. His Mr. Wonderful entry in the main event currently ranks top 25 overall. And hopefully I did not jinx you there. Ladies and gentlemen, Travis Sochik. What's going on, Travis?
It's great to be with you. Long-time listener, first-time guest. So, I'm a big fan of yours, Vlad, so it's nice to be with you chatting.
Thank you, Travis. I appreciate it. And those that don't follow him on Twitter, although I'm sure you do, especially if you listen to baseball podcasts on Twitter, he's at Travis_Sochik, and that's Sawchik. So I'm pretty excited about this because it's kind of the worlds colliding. Obviously, you are a fantasy baseball player, but it's not your essence, so to speak, because you are a longtime writer. Obviously, you've written a couple books. You also come a lot from the other perspective of strictly baseball without the fantasy part of it. And most of our guests have been NFBC players, or obviously a very sort of high stakes centric data analysis type podcast. But I was very excited to have you on. And then, and of course, I've followed you over the years, known about you for some time, but just kind of digging in a little bit more about you made me realize there are a lot of things I wanted to ask you and learn. So I'm very much looking forward to our conversation today.
Yeah, likewise. And I think there's quite a bit of carryover between these two worlds. I mean, there's a lot of great analysts in the fantasy community, and their work is as valuable or useful as a lot of the analysts you'll find on, I think, other well-known sabermetric sites. So I learn a lot from folks in the community. And I think there's a lot of carryover. So it's nice to be in both worlds, and now they're colliding today. So this should be fun.
I kind of wanted to start from the beginning as far as, where you grew up, your first experiences with baseball, your favorite team that you grew up with, and just anything memorable as a kid, like, the players you followed and jerseys you loved, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I grew up in the east suburbs of Cleveland. So I was sort of, I was raised in a Cleveland Guardians and Indians family, and my dad, most my friends and extended family were all big Indians fans, so that was sort of, I was indoctrinated into that, into the game, and I loved it, even though the team didn't have much success when I was a kid. And I remember going into Old Municipal Stadium, I'm that old where I remember going into the Guardians' previous home, and even though it was not a first-class facility, I thought it was great. And then, when I walked into Progressive Field the first time, its first game, the exhibition game against the Pirates before they opened it against the Mariners in 94, I was just awestruck as a 13-14-year-old then. Thought it was amazing. So, yeah, I grew up as a huge baseball fan, sports fan in general, but baseball was the first love, and that's how I arrived at it. And, I'm very lucky to be involved in something that I've always been passionate about. And look, here we are talking about fantasy baseball today. So how lucky are we?
And you were, who did you like, Joey Bell better or Albert Bell? Or did you kind of like them equally?
Yeah. He became Albert, of course. And he also became a superstar player then. And, Yeah, those mid-90s Indians teams, my teenage years, I mean, they were amazing. And you think about like Manny Ramirez batting sixth in that lineup, Jim Thome batting seventh or something like that, and Kenny Lofton as a dynamic leadoff guy. Very vivid memories of those teams. And I'm still a little bitter about the Atlanta Braves getting, you know, 4 inches off the plate in the 95 World mm-hmm. Series and all that. So it's yeah, that team had, I mean, they traded, they developed power so easily, dynamic offensive players. Later on, they're trading Brian Giles for Ricardo Rincon, but they couldn't develop pitching. And now it's sort of the reverse, where they have the majors' worst run scoring group, but they have this pitching factory. So it's funny how that's changed. But yeah, I was actually a huge Carlos Baerga fan when I was a kid. I thought, I don't know why we get into random players when we're kids, but I thought it was cool that he's a switch hitter. And I saw him in person recently. It was like, if he was in Cleveland, where I still live, after a long tour of a journey in media, I've returned home. I saw Baerga at Progressive Field a few weeks ago. I was like, wow, if 14-year-old me or 12-year-old me could be here, he'd be like awestruck and slack-jawed. But yeah, it's kind of funny.
And at least for myself, I got into it so much. I mean, I think one of the things growing up, I grew up as a Dodger fan, watch Angels, watch as much baseball as I could, and really was so enamored with players. I guess, I don't know, just the way that their swagger, the way they would step up to the plate, the way that they'd swing the bat, you know, their stance and whatnot. You think back to, I mean, from Gary Sheffield to, you know, Julio Franco and all these different players that had their own personality when they came to bat. And I know we still have some of that, but it just kind of hits different when it's, you know, these players from our youth. And baseball cards, at least for me, played a big part in that. I don't know if you grew up collecting, but yeah, I mean, I was just obsessed and just, you know, I mean, I'm Russian. I grew up playing ice hockey. I mean, granted, I came over here, I was 2 months old. Some American is, you know, can be. But this is the sport that always seemed to pull me for whatever reason. And still to this day, it's my first love. But did you collect baseball cards as well?
I did. And I wonder if that is, I mean, I don't know how old you are exactly, but I wonder for someone like late 30s, early 40s, if that was kind of an entry point into fantasy where I did collect cards. And I remember going into card stores when they were still a thing in every strip mall. And, you know, friends, older brothers trying to, you know, rip you off for a Ken Griffey Jr. rated rookie from Don for Us or something. So I remember, yeah, that feeling of opening a pack and hoping you get certain cards and making those deals with your buddies. I think that probably did lead into like the early pre-internet fantasy leagues I was in, where we would have a draft in someone's, you know, a basement of a friend, and we would write down the names and we would stick with it for like a month trying to tabulate stats via newspaper box scores. But after a while, it became too tedious to track down late night box scores. And who's going to really want to do this for 6 months? So they always ended. Those first attempts always ended early. But yeah, I think trading cards probably led into fantasy interest for me. That's what I would suspect, something like that. I don't know what your first entry into fantasy was, but I think there's probably a relationship there for me.
Absolutely. And from your timeline, I think we're probably similar age. I'm born 79, so I'm 44. So, you know, mid 90s. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember between the ages of like 11 to 15, I was obsessed with the stats of baseball. And I just remember, like you said, and I've talked about it in podcasts previous, like getting that morning paper for me at the time, it was the LA Times and the Daily News, and just like changing. I had this like this glass thing on my desk, and underneath I would put papers that I would change out every day that would have stats leaders that I would compile myself, and then like my list of favorite players, and then my hot list, and then like how Beckett did it with the, you know, the pluses up two, down three of like my favorite, you know, players of the week. And yeah, I was obsessed. That absolutely was my entry point and yes. What got me obsessed early on.
Yeah, I remember those Becketts and picking up the magazine and getting an endorphin rush when you saw the up arrow next to your guy. Absolutely. So similar experience. And it's probably so many people that are listening and don't remember the feeling and opening up a broadsheet newspaper and going through the box scores or the stats leaders. And Yeah, that's I mean, we're never going back to those days, and but it's fun to romanticize about them. And there's still something about the print product.
Yes, there absolutely is. And the only way that I get some, you know, I guess nostalgia from it is when I'm taking my dog on a walk and I see somebody, you know, still getting the paper, which is nice. It's just kind of like this nice feeling. I'm like, oh, I don't know you, but I appreciate you. What about on the writing side? Is that something that you kind of always done? What was your, were you like a, you know, journalism major in college? What was sort of your career path, you know, through, from high school to college, you know, what you studied and what led you into, you know, kind of where you are now?
Yeah, I went to Ohio State and I didn't quite know what I wanted to do when I showed up there. At first I thought I wanted to be a history major, but then I learned there wasn't a whole lot of the practical use for that degree. It was pretty narrow and limited. So then I chose another dying industry, journalism. And I thought, I was a journalism major and I thought like the newspaper decline would be kind of slow and steady, but it's, the whole disruption's been much more quick, much more accelerated much more quickly than I thought. But so I went up kind of a traditional route that doesn't exist anymore. It's almost like minor league baseball, where you try to jump from smaller after you graduate, you try to jump from smaller newspapers and smaller markets to larger newspapers and larger markets. And I started out at a small paper in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. I went to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where I covered Coastal Carolina and preps, some ACC, then Post and Courier and Charleston, South Carolina, which was sort of like AAA, covered Clemson. And then my then I went to Pittsburgh in 2013, which was my, I guess, my first so-called big break, where I was able to cover a pro beat, covered a Pirates, which was a real thrill. And it was an exciting time to be there because they're, of course, ending the longest streak of consecutive losing seasons in North American pro sports history. And that was, those were fun teams to be around. The Russell Martin, Prime McCutcheon, Liriano teams, Starling Marte. So it was fun to be in Pittsburgh for, I covered four seasons there, 13, 14, 15, 16. And then I went to Fangraphs, did some part-time stuff at The Athletic. And then I went to 538 briefly, and now I'm at The Score. So that's sort of like the whole circle. And then when I went to Fangraphs, we moved back to Cleveland, where my parents still live and where we had some help for the kids and just to be closer to home. So sort of round trip, made it back. But that's the in a nutshell glance at my writing career.
On the beat writer side, so for me, it's interesting. You get a mix of, how do I put this? I'm always curious, and you obviously have this perspective of what beat writers think of fantasy folks, because you do have some that are pretty responsive, but for the most part, they are not. And I understand folks are busy or they have got a lot going on, or maybe they don't want to maybe share certain info or maybe not have certain info. Or maybe not even think, you know, take fantasy seriously because for whatever reason, but obviously everybody's different. Every beat writer is different, but what's your perspective as to perhaps why in many cases when a fantasy person is even respectfully, nicely asking for info, you almost kind of getting, you know, kind of getting that feel of getting a little big time. Is that just in my head or is this something that is real?
What struck me was, you know, just tweeting out the lineup card, there's a real desire for that information. And I'm prime from fantasy gambling circles more so than the fans on some occasion. So I realized how important it was, which I didn't really have an understanding until I came to the Pirates beat, where, you know, I would be most cited on, like, if you Google your name, it would come up on like a Roto Baller. You know, you would find your name attached to just injury updates and the thirst for it, lineup changes, throwing progressions. So I understood that there was, in addition to the local fan base, there was a lot of craving for information out there that I wasn't. I mean, I played fantasy all along during this period too, but it wasn't until I was on the Pirates beat that I understood that people want information as quick as they can have it, and or prospect updates, all sorts of things. So I don't know if that, I guess that's kind of a rambling response to your question. I don't know if it answers it, but yeah, I always respected the fantasy community because I always enjoyed playing it. And yeah, I understood that as a beat writer, you have information people need, and even if it's nuts and bolts, it still serves a purpose.
And for those that ignore in general, and you may not have this experience because you can get your information in different ways. It's not a, I mean, is it just they're busy? Is it, you know, too cool for school? No respect for fantasy? What do you think?
Yeah. It's certainly case to case. I'm sure some folks believe they're above kind of the fantasy fray, or even I entered the business when there's still that old guard traditional newspaper group and the new kind of blogging community. And there's a lot of the old guard didn't want the new guard in the clubhouse initially and in the press box. So I sort of, and I came up through the traditional route, and now I'm no longer in a traditional newspaper role. But yeah, there was definitely case by case, but some people did not want to interact or help for a variety of reasons. But yeah, just from my perspective, I always enjoyed playing and interacting with folks. And I've found over the years that, you know, analysts and people in the fantasy community have do an excellent job covering the sport and analyzing the sport. And I've always enjoyed playing it. So I try to help when I can.
And from your years in Pittsburgh and being close to the Pirates, can you just tell us, I mean, you can abstain on the second question, but the first one, is there someone that stood out to you that was incredibly nice and warm to you, or that you just saw, you know, kind of around the world that people may not know, like, wow, this is a really great guy. And then on the flip side, and again, you can abstain here, but like just somebody who you're like, man, this guy's kind of a jerk and I didn't really know it.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember Jared Hughes, the relief pitcher. Mm-hmm. Had a pretty long career and made a number of stops, but he was the nicest guy in the world. And I think it helps if guys aren't bothered every day by the media, that they're maybe more willing to chat or engage, or, you know, small talk or greet you with a smile. But he was a great guy, always in good spirits, would always greet you with a smile and always willing to chat. And Russ Martin was great for like his insights in the game, and such a smart player. And he helped me understand the game much better than when I went in. And I think he was invaluable to those Pirates teams and was sort of the OG guy in getting paid for framing skills. And he was one of the faces of that skill when it was first quantified. So it was interesting to talk to him about skill development there and how he developed his craft. And I think so much in the game today is, can you learn the skill? Can you improve it? And I think he is one of the early examples that you can, to some degree. Jameson Taillon, great guy, great to speak with. I still talk to him for stories on occasion. And Neil Walker was from Pittsburgh, so he was sort of the mayor of the clubhouse. So he was bothered for every topic because of his local ties. And to his credit, I mean, you can imagine being asked every day about a variety of topics. He always did it. So I always respected him for standing from his locker and taking a wide variety of questions you know, all the time. As far as the second part, I didn't have any terrible relationships with players, but I did have to, AJ Burnett did want an apology from me one time for some critical piece I'd written, and we disagreed on how I some context I put around one of his performances, and he wasn't real happy with me. But, you know, I didn't have a terrible relationship with him, but he wasn't happy with me that day. But all in all, it was a good team to be around for the most part, and it helped because they were winning. If it was, you know, four straight 100 plus lost seasons, it might have been a different environment. So, as they say, I was just in the Rangers clubhouse for a story, and that was a very happy work environment. So it helps. Winning cures a lot of problems. So it was a good time to be in Pittsburgh.
You said you were in the Rangers not too long ago?
I was. Yeah, when they were in Pittsburgh, I made the trip down just to kind of examine the best I could in one series. What's going on here? What's the secret? And some of it was analytical base, looking at improvements they've made, but other there's some soft science aspect too, where Nathaniel Lowe is, he's like, this is a happy clubhouse, man. And when you get people that are a good group of people together that feel like they have some, they have good coaching instruction, but also autonomy, and it helps to want to show up at work and do your best. And so I do believe there's something to that, even though it's difficult to measure. If you want to show up, if you like the culture of your workspace and you want to show up, it has to matter to some degree. Of course, others might say that's just what happens when you win. So I don't know. But the Rangers, maybe it's a Bruce Bochy thing too. I think he does something where he gets players to play free and easy, and they're not worried about making a mistake on the field or having one bad game, that sort of thing. So I do think, even though it's maybe impossible to measure, there's something to that, in addition to all the great players that they have in Texas right now.
Well, I was going to say, obviously, when things are going well, when you know, winning is contagious, and I mean, at least I think so, and you get this group together and just kind of playing light and easy, and just that when things are going well, of course, it's a much happier locker room. That makes sense. My theory is that wherever Donnie, the other Donnie Baseball, Donnie Ecker goes, is where success happens to matriculate or occur. We saw what he did, that magic, a couple seasons ago with you know, reviving Brandon Crawford's career and all those Giants. I mean, it was just incredible. And now just his second year, I remember I was speaking with, it was like Jonah Heim's dad a couple of years ago, right before he really kind of blew up. And yeah, I asked him about Donnie, and he just arrived to the team. And Jonah wasn't even sure to make the team yet. Then of course he did. And the last season went well, or at least the first half did. But and, you know, they've gone through some rough times, and it's taken a season for things to go off. And I understand he's just one of the many cogs that make these things happen. But I do think there's some magic here with him, because if you look at the roster, I mean, it's you're getting stuff out of guys like Leody Taveras and, you know, Jonah Heim. He's, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the number one catcher in fantasy, or top three. Just everything going together. Corey Seager's hitting 350 with a 400 OBP. Marcus Simeon is just mashing it. And ironically, I remember when things were not going so well, I heard some rumor about Marcus Simeon and Seager not getting along. Whereas when they first came to the team, I was like, oh, they're best buddies and this and that. So it's just funny how, first of all, how rumors can occur, how Donnie and these other coaches, Bochy, are influencing this team, and how also these rumors sort of dissipate when things are going well and you're just winning.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's something to the Ecker connection, because yeah, what happened in San Francisco it has some carryover to Texas, where they've seemingly almost everyone in that lineup, like in San Francisco 2 years ago, is playing at or near career best levels. And I know they've brought over some new training techniques. I mean, I assume most teams are trying to create more game-like practice environments before games, with the, you know, more high-speed work on more high-speed velocity, more spin, more differential training, where hitters aren't sure if they're going to face a breaking ball or a fastball from the machine or the coach. So he's definitely brought some of that. And even Marcus Simeon was saying he wish he had access to, like, these, I guess they use these foam balls and the high-speed machines. And he's saying that's been a valuable training tool for him, because earlier in his career, he wouldn't want to take high-velocity BP every game, because what if you jam yourself, blow up your hands? Like, he didn't want to risk that. Where now, with some of the new training tools, you can do that more often. And he feels like that helps. And they try to mimic that day's starting pitcher, fastball shape. He says it's all about fastball shape. So again, Spencer Strider a few weeks ago, they had, it was four runs. But against Strider, that's a pretty huge number. And I think they had nine base runners. And you know, they worked on creating that fastball plane, and that it's hard to mimic the deception he has, but and the extension. But there's something to more game-like prep that I think baseball was behind for a lot of years, where a sport like the NFL, I think in their practices, they do a better job of preparing for opponents and replicating game-like situations. I think Ecker is someone who, one of the kind of new agey coaches who's brought that in, and Tim Heyer is the other hitting coach there. Does a great job of that too. So I definitely think there's something to your point, where some of those new practices brought over from San Francisco and hires from Boston have definitely helped extract more out of these guys, in addition to the good clubhouse vibes, for what those are worth. And I think those are worth something too, even if it's just a byproduct of winning.
You mentioned something about shape, and it interesting that you bring it up, because it is a term that I feel has been popping up a little bit more in the fantasy community. And I do feel that many times fantasy players, especially when things aren't going well, are chasing newer advanced stats or sometimes an end all be all, something that can encompass everything to really give them an idea, where we know through our experience through playing that there really isn't one thing. There are just multiple levels and regular data. I mean, standard data, advanced data, what we're seeing on the field, like all of these things matter. But on the shape side, it has become more of something that I've looked into, because it does seem to me that it matters. And I apologize if I'm messing up his last name, but Lance Brazowski, I believe, from Driveline. He's doing these videos.
I think that's correct, but I don't want to, I cannot verify that, but I think that's correct. But yeah, I know he's doing a great job on Twitter with updating pitch shape changes. Yep.
Yeah, and I'm trying to learn, because, like, for me, for example, I don't know what you think of or what you thought of Brandon Fott before the season, but one of the main reasons that I liked him, despite not seeing him much myself, was the fact that he was able to be, he was very efficient and had a lot of endurance within his starts in the minor leagues. And I remember he led AAA in innings pitched, in strikeouts, and in number of starts that went over seven innings. And so, for me, that seemed to be like a factor, recipe for success in perhaps his first season. And so I did invest in him in the preseason, was very excited to see how he would evolve. And then a lot of the stuff, the noise I was hearing in the background, is the fastball. There's something that's not right. If the shape is off, it's the stuff plus, like, all these things about his fastball started to concern me. And of course, me trying to be like, oh, but I'm, that investment bias, right? Like, oh, I'm invested in him. It's probably nothing. He'll be fine. And then we saw it for ourselves, right? He just didn't look good. Obviously, has some other secondary pitchers that perhaps he can evolve. But, like, do you have any opinion on him there, and just how these sort of new revelations or things about his mechanics and his actual pitch himself affect your fantasy opinion?
Yeah, I have three NFC teams, and I had him on 150 draft champions and an OC. And yeah, for a lot of the same reasons you mentioned, the volume was huge. And he looked good in the spring too, for what that's worth. He was effective. But I didn't hear much about his fastball shape until he arrived at the majors and was getting hit around pretty severely. And I think it just shows you how important it is to be able to live in the zone, get away with mistakes in the zone, pitch in the zone. Alec Manoah in Toronto is having a lot of issues this year too, with a tick down and stuff. And then there's, why does Joe Ryan succeed with similar velocity, but much more swing and miss? So trying to quantify, I think shape plus deception is huge. And with Fott, that investment's not looking great for our fantasy teams this year. Hopefully he'll figure it out and improve that and get back to more the expected results. But yeah, I do think fastball shape's one of the things I've been just fascinated in, just in baseball coverage recent years. Chris Bassett, I think, has found a way to hack. He doesn't have a high spin fastball, but he's found a way to throw it and live at the top of the zone with stuff that probably doesn't jump out on a lot of models. Joe Ryan again. So trying to understand what makes a lot of guys throw 98, but not a lot of guys get Spencer Strider's results. So what's going on there? So I do think establishing the fastball goes back to this dawn of the game, but it still matters. And I think learning why it matters, we just have more information now. And I think, fantasy community, just like baseball clubs, or understanding what makes a fastball play, and it's super important.
And actually, one of the things that really kind of chaps my hide, I guess, is when people are very quick, people on Twitter, I guess you could say, it always comes up to, it's the people on Twitter, it's coming with the pitchforks, when a player that you've kind of hitched, you know, your post to, and that you've invested in, you've drafted in, you've been kind of touting for a long time, when they don't succeed, it's like, you know, hey, but you thought, you said this. Yes, but also, you know, I'm going to be wrong, whatever it is, 40%. I don't know what the number is of the time on these, but 50%, 60%, who knows, depending on the season. And also, these are not widgets. These are not, you know, stocks. These are human beings that go through different things, and some evolve and some get better. And Alek Manoah is at, you know, the bottom of everyone's, you know, crap list. And next, you know, end of the season, he could be one of the hottest pitchers. We don't know. They all adjust. Not all, but, you know, that things just change, evolve. It's not that simple. It's not a linear thing with almost all of these pitchers and hitters.
Yeah, if you're only wrong 40% of the time, you're probably doing really well in whether it's fantasy players or stocks or what I'm making baseball predictions. So, yeah, I imagine being in your shoes, it's not pleasant when you make a call. It's just like if I write a piece about making a prediction, I'm still hearing from Astros fans about a piece I wrote a few weeks ago, and I stand by it, but you know, people come out and they remember the missed calls more than the calls you get correct. So yeah, it's something. They're definitely not widgets. I mean, I think Manoah, the news broke today that he's going to go down to Dunedin, and that's where the Blue Jays facility is, and work with their coaches and go in the pitching lab there. And that's what he needs to do. He was rushed to the majors because he was so successful, and he's got a long career ahead of him, but it makes sense to get him off the major league mound and try to get some things figured out. And they aren't widgets. And I think one thing about the season, not to go off on a tangent, but it's been a reminder that development is not linear, and some of the best picks this year from in the best values in fantasy have been reminders of that, and some of the misses too. They are not widgets, and this season's been a great reminder of that.
Pivoting real quick, I wanted to talk about the writing of a book and that whole process and the motivation. So how did it evolve with Big Data Baseball, your book about the Pirates and their losing streak? Because the idea start when you, like, in your first or second year as a beat writer for them, and then how did that whole thing evolve?
So showing up in Pittsburgh, well, it was a captivating story to show up there. First time on a major league beat, and the city rallied around this team that had, they were starving for a winner. And Pittsburgh's one of those, it's not a transient town, so they root for any team that's doing well with Pittsburgh across the front of their jerseys, they're going to embrace, and just a great environment. And I was one of the, you know, I read Moneyball as I think as a sophomore in college or something like that. No, just out of college. And when I read it, I sort of regretted like my career choice. Like, damn, it would be awesome to be one of these kids stepping out of college with an econ or computer science degree and join a team. So I sort of regretted after I remember reading that, like, oh shit, this is what I should have done. But I felt like the Pirates were sort of embracing some of the next generation Moneyball practices. The pitch framing was just being quantified then. Pitch FX was, some of those insights weren't that old that they were taking advantage of. And can you change pitch shape? And one of the first, Marlon Byrd, who they acquired at a deadline, I think it was the 2013 season, he was one of the first swing change guys. And I had always had this belief that all those reps, tens of thousands of reps as an amateur, you kind of developed a swing plane or approach, and it was really difficult to change. And he was the first player who I was around and who I spoke with who changed almost overnight. One off season, he went to an outside swing coach, Doug Latta, in suburban LA, and he became a fly ball hitter. And that really struck me. And he was under the cloud of Ped use, and he'd been suspended, so everyone credited his power spike to that, but he changed his batted ball profile. And I was like, huh. So all these kind of interesting elements came together, and I was like, this feels like Moneyball too. So maybe somewhat derivative, but I felt like this is a really cool story. I would say anyone who's interested in writing a book, you have to feel like super passionate about the project, because it is a lot of work. It is a lot of man hours, especially if you have a day job on top of it. So yeah, I really felt an urgency to write it. I didn't want anyone else to write the story. I wanted to have this ownership to get it. And something more than I'd written some long form newspaper pieces, but I felt it was a bigger story than that. And I just, I told the Pirates I was going to write it so they could help me or not. And I was still around the team, so I had the benefit of clubhouse access and seeing the story in person. So you do have to find to be published in a traditional way, you have to find an agent and have them pitch it to book publishers. So I had to go through that process. But yeah, it's something you have to feel really passionate. There has to be an urgency. And that's how it sort of came together, just kind of right place, right time, and maybe feeling a little bit like the Moneyball story sort of missed on, and maybe this is like the next chapter, and maybe I can help write it. So that's how it sort of came together.
It, all in all, how long did it take you from the very first word that you typed until it was completed, like not including edits and changes? And also follow up to that is this is different, right? It's not like you're writing a fiction novel. You're not like, this is a very research based. You're obviously adding your story and your feel to it. But did you encounter writer's block at all, or like a loss of confidence in the middle, or just did it just flow the whole time?
I never had. I occasionally have writer's block, but I think writing nonfiction, it probably helps a little bit with that. I've never attempted to write fiction other than like creative writing class. But since it was my first book attempt, like halfway through, the publisher was like, "Yeah, this is too newspapery. This isn't working." I was like, "Oh no!" So I really had to go back to the drawing board after like 30. The first batch was like 35,000 words or something, and it had to be totally overhauled. But they helped coach me up a little bit, and I had to think more like you're writing a movie script and be more color. I don't want to get into the weeds, but yeah, so there was a learning process in that. But they did Flatiron Press. They were good. They helped me through it, and it was, I'm trying to think, it was probably like a 12-month process from typing the first words to putting together the finished manuscript. And then then you have to go back and forth on some edits and other logistical things. But it was probably a year-long process, and I didn't have any kids at that point, so it was easy. For a beat job, most games are 7 o'clock start, so you don't have to be in the clubhouse about 3 p.m. So I would walk, get my morning coffee, then late morning, early afternoon, I had a second job. I was writing a book and reporting on it. So yeah, it was like a second job for a year. But that's tough. And the other funny, it wasn't funny then, but I had started writing it. It was based off the 2013 season. And the publisher wanted to feel kind of assured that they would be a continued success story, that it wasn't a one hit wonder. And the Pirates were terrible to start the 2014 season. I was getting emails like, are they going to turn this around, or is this just kind of a fluke story?
Oh, so, man.
I was really, you're not supposed to root for the team you cover as a beat writer, but I was definitely rooting for the 2014 Pirates, and they did return to the playoffs. So that was huge.
Yeah.
So there's some worry about that. And I was thinking about, because I believe his name is Alan Shipnuck, a golf writer, and he had just shared on Twitter yesterday, he had, I guess, just finished a manuscript about live golf, and he was so happy to be done with it. And of course, today it turns out he's not done with it, because there's a whole other chapter as that merger takes hold. So yeah, writing about current events can be, I consider that a kind of a current event genre. There's a lot of it out of your control. What if the Pirates were terrible? So you do take a risk in that too.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And then just real quick before we pivot to the to a little fantasy talk, the second book, how did that come about? Is this you pitching to Ben to you? You guys were working together at the Fangraphs at the time, is that right?
We had Ben I think he was at the Ringer then. Ben had written a great book previously, and we had the same agent. He'd written The Only Rule with Sam Miller, and we had interestingly come to our agent with similar ideas about kind of this new kind of player who had new ways of getting better and could, the idea that they could improve skills and raise their ceilings in ways they hadn't before. And it sort of goes back to, Marlon Byrd is the first player who opened my eyes to this. I said, wow, you can change your swing path and you can become a new kind of player. And of course, it coincided with the rise of pitch design and driveline baseball and the idea that, you can just create a breaking ball or hone a breaking ball or velocity building. And this was sort of at the beginning edge of that. And we just thought, this is something that's happened in real time. And if we don't document it, someone else is going to. And we both felt it was like the most important subject in baseball was player to, just as player evaluation had kind of been, I feel like the first part of the data age revolution in baseball was just understanding player evaluation, that on-base percentage was more important than batting average, that sort of thing. But I think the second part two of the data age in baseball is using, it's more player development focused. How do you use the new tech and information to get more out of players? And I think the Dodgers, the Astros, Guardians on the pitching side, Tampa Bay, they've all done, they're all poster children for this, along with the players doing the work. So that's how that came about. And again, if you're interested in writing a book, you really have to want to do it, because it is rewarding ultimately, but going through it is, there's no substitute for time and reporting. So you can do it, but you have to really want to do it.
Yeah. One day I'm going to write a fantasy book. I don't know if that's what I'm kind of asking you.
Yeah, you absolutely should.
Yes. Just time. Need to find that time. Speaking of fantasy, wanted to talk about this main event team that you have. It's looking pretty good. You and I had exchanged some messages in the preseason, and I remember looking at your DC at the time, your draft champions from NFBC. I was like, all right, hey, this is looking pretty good. This looks like we might be on the same page on a few things this season. But first of all, the team, it moved up in the standings actually since I started writing it. I think you had a good Monday. You get like Martin Perez and some others, but either way, the team is looking, it's top 25 at this point in the overall, in the main event. It's in second place. You got some tough competition there, but I feel like the team has good structure, but some good players in that league. There's my friend Jason Anthony's in it. One of our super subs of FTN, at least that's what I call him, Matt Hurley, known as Moose. And then you guys got John Stadmuller. So if you don't know that name, he's been in NFBC since day one. He's a great guy, but he, one day his wife, he's fine me telling the story, but one day his wife is like, you know what, you're really good at this. And I do really well. How about you just quit your job and just play NFBC full time. So that's what John does. Obviously and other stuff, they have kids and things, but yeah, he's a great player, but this is a very competitive league and you've got quite the team here. So, as I dig into it, an incredible balance on the hitting and pitching. For me, most of my hitting is doing well. I've got a few teams that are not doing so well in pitching, trying to work on that. But as far as just like looking at where you are in all 10 category standings, you're in the upper half or even in the top four in almost all of the categories in your league. Only runs is an issue, and even barely so. It's ninth in the league. But first of all, like, go back to when you drafted it. I don't know if this was your first main event or you had done in the past, but just give us a little starter here on the main event.
Yeah, so this is my third main event team. I've done one team per year the last three, and I think the first time I was in an NFC league was the COVID year. I think there's some OC, like short season, because I had just been on Twitter. Somehow these worlds started to collide where I followed more and more fantasy analysts and I saw more and more talk about these high stakes leagues. And I like competing. Even if I have a low probability chance of winning, I still enjoy competing. And just as a side note, I feel like it actually helps me in my job because it forces me to lock in on every box score. And I mean, I guess you could argue you should be doing that anyway, but if you're invested financially, even a small bit, I think, you want to be up on every trend, every player, every bullpen situation, all the playing time. So it's helped me like lock in a way that I don't think otherwise I would. So just, and then I would hear more and more about this main event, and I started listening to, and a lot of the industry podcasts talk about the main event. So when I started hearing about it, like, all right, I gotta be a part of this. So I play, and the first year was 21, and I had no idea what I was doing. I hadn't played in many fab leagues before. I had played Roto before. Like I played Diamond Challenge.
Yes.
Dad used to, I remember my dad calling in like lineup changes. This was before the web, and you had to like call in your lineup change. It was like $2.50 to $2.50. Like, do we really want to buy this guy for $10? So I remember doing that. And then for some reason, I think it was going off to college or whatnot. I still played in a home league with friends, but I didn't get back into Roto. So anyways, this is how I got back to main event and the Roto style. And it just became, I really enjoyed my first experience, even though I think I only finished middle of the pack, I think lower 300s or middle 300s out of, I don't know if it was 700 teams in 21, but I did learn a lot. I learned more about fab. I ran into resources like your fab work, which is so important and so great. And I think it's become like a benchmark for a lot of players. And I feel like that range, we see a lot of bids falling within the error bars. So yeah, the first couple of years were learning experience, and actually interviewed Phil Dussault for a story about his great, Jeff Zimmerman direct messaged me last year, and he's like, during Phil's great season, or his great, where he won everything. He's like, you got to write a story about this guy. And I was still kind of early on in the community and didn't know a lot of folks yet. And I talked to Phil, and he interviewed him for probably an hour for the piece, and I learned some of his secrets. And I came away with that thinking, okay, people take this very seriously, and his process was like pristine. It's like, if you want this to, you're just going to get your ass kicked if you don't step up your game. And so I came away with that thinking, okay, do you want to actually try to compete? So I upped my game this offseason, and maybe it has nothing to do with a good start, but I did create my own model. I tested different skills to see, okay, does this matter? I think it does. Does it? And I sort of created my own player values. And I also wanted to do that to not get emotional in draft room and just go by your board. And that, and I sort of did that, not always. But yeah, that's a long rambling response. But that's how I got into the main event. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. And even on days that aren't going so well, I try to remind myself this is fun. And the season, it's not all year. We don't get to do this all year. So don't try to get too pissed when the bullpen blows Martin Perez's lead last night. Mm. And yeah, it's still a game. We're still doing this for fun. Only one person's going to win. There's a reason we all still come back. You know?
That article, by the way, was excellent. I believe I messaged you after. I don't think I really knew you all that well, but I remember like it was, and I was proud also of Phil and just the industry, just kind of, you know, a prominent writer and, you know, on kind of a big stage. It was really nice to see for us. And Phil obviously did us proud with that excellent season. But
oh, yeah. Thanks. Yeah. I mean, I think Phil could work in a front office or he's got a great mind for it, and he's disciplined and he has a process. And yeah, I was, I don't think I can regularly beat people like Phil, but I've never won anything. Well, I did finish fifth in the 2008 Diamond Challenge. That's as close as I've come.
Hey, that's like,
but yeah, no, I mean, I learned things from Phil that I've tried to use in other aspects of life. Just be more disciplined in things, whether it's investing or whatever. Have a process. Know when to be contrarian and not follow the crowd, I think, is something he did really well that season. And some of it wasn't even data-based. I think this is correct. I think he really liked the White Sox starters that year because Giolito had changed someone was getting a lot of publicity in the preseason about changes they'd made. And he thought, okay, why can't other guys on the staff do that? And I think that led him to, I'm trying to remember the big breakouts for that season, but I believe that's correct. I think Logan Webb was another guy. He was big on that year. Robbie Ray.
Yep. He essentially nailed all those late round guys. And
right.
And yeah, I mean, and he does, like you mentioned, with your process is kind of taking the emotional out of it. You've built your model. and you have your values and you just start sticking to that. Him and I have talked before how he does realize there's certain things that he misses on certain players because you don't have that sort of personalized feel. But at the end of the day, it always ends up being a balance. But then that's something that he can almost, you know, test and sort of quantify into his model as well, that, you know, those unknowns.
Yeah, I think there's so many great players. And I was listening to your was it Dave Potts who you?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, so I was driving home from Toronto. I went in, the score is based in Toronto, and I went in there to meet people for the first time because COVID and border restrictions, I never actually met anyone. And I was listening to that podcast on the way home, driving along I-90 and bringing on Sexy back. And I wish I would have wish I had incorporated a little bit more of that into this team I drafted this year. But yeah, so I had some regrets listening to that on the way home. And I know, like, even a lot of good players are, just try to hit singles doubles early on. But my board, it said Jacob DeGrom was a first round value if he could get to 115, 120 innings. And, I was big on O'Neill Cruz because of some of the underlying stuff and believing, what if he could change? What if he could trim sort of some Phil like think? Well, what if he could cut his strikeout rate more than people think? I mean, why can't he be a 30-30 guy? He has the underlying tools. That was an unfortunate injury, but I still think that could have been possible. I'm rambling here, but that was sort of just where my mind went with some of those questions.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the fab part of it in a little bit, but I was going to mention that, first of all, just a little bit more in detail about this team. So you do have a little Sexy, I think, with the Rays. You're on the Rays train as well here. You got three guys there, Wander Franco, and I'm assuming that your Mr. Wonderful is an homage to him, right?
Of course. He's the only player I have on all my teams. I thought he was one of the most undervalued guys going into the year.
And it's also Mr. Wonderful back in our 80s days. Isn't that like Paul Orndorff or something, the wrestler, right?
I think that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you have that nice base of Rays, which I love. My team littered with Rays. Ironically, no Arizarena. Not necessarily by design, but just, I don't know. I like the later Rays, the values there more. You waited for Tatis. I'm assuming that is your end of first, early second round pick, probably.
Yeah, he was a second rounder. Yeah. I definitely didn't bring Unsexy back when I started DeGrom Tatis. And that's right. Well, he was a second rounder. But I was going by the board, though. It wasn't necessarily emotional or trying to be sexy. It was like, I put in my estimates for playing time, and I think Tatis was only like 480 plate appearances, but I still had him as like I don't forget what it was, but like 34 home runs, 25 steals. Like, okay, maybe I should take Freeman there, but I'm going to listen to the board. I was hoping someone would take Tatis. So I did, cause I didn't want to do it. I was like, all right, I'm doing it because he's there.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the best deals are just kind of what the board drops on you. So, and also keep in mind, Phil won the overall with DeGrom as his first round pick and missed him, dropped him, basically, I believe, last July or August or two July or Augusts ago. So you got DeGrom on the sidelines. Rest of your offense pretty solid, probably waiting for a little bit of a bounce back from Dalton Varsho. You got Bryson Stott at a good price, Nolan Gorman. So your middle is set. Buxton to come back would sure be nice. George Springer lead off atop that lineup at some point, figure that the Rays will get hot. And then your pitching, you don't have like really many super aces, but you know, Lodolo you have stashed. You've got Joe Ryan, kind of getting the most out of guys that some of them we thought would be good, but not to this degree. Joe Ryan, we saw his helium by the time main event season come around. It was like, you know, like a 150, 160 ADP guy to like 98. 100 by the time we got to main event. But either way, he's been doing well. Mitch Keller, amazing. The aforementioned Martin Perez. And also got some good numbers there out of Michael Lorenzen. And then now, so check this out. You're top 25 overall. And again, not trying to kind of, you know, perk, you know, the team or fluff it. And then at the same time, not trying to jinx it. But you got McKenzie and Glasnow back at a great time. On top of that, three closers. You got AJ Puk, why don't we say that? AJ Puck, Paul Sewald, and Alex Lang. So you got your three closer base. This is a pretty decent squad. It's got good structure for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I did. I was shooting for balanced players. I mean, I think some of the criticism would be there's way too much risk on this team. And I guess one of my contrarian points going into the season was, well, I don't think we actually understand injury risk that well. And I also think we think the safe players are safer than they actually are. So I was okay. In part, this is just what my system spit out, but also because I feel like I think we over, there's too much overconfidence in, he's safe or he's risky. So far that doesn't look correct on, so far I have egg on my face for DeGrom, but we'll see. And I want to balance. I didn't know what the steals environment would be. So I wanted as many guys who at least had like above average sprint speed as possible. Cause I thought all the rules changes might change their thinking when they get on base or the team's aggressiveness. So I wanted well-balanced skill sets. And I've been in positions before where I've tried to do like the rabbit guy and add the power only guys. And it just always seemed to blow up in my face. So I wanted to get away from that. And I've seen some other, I don't know if it was Jeff Zimmerman or Tanner Bell, just talking about kind of that optionality. Even if you're a company or something, you want to have optionality. And if something goes wrong, you have this balance and you can pivot more easily. Or in a draft, if you're balanced, you can take advantage of values more easily. So that was something I did try to incorporate. And I think so far it's worked out pretty well. Like Buxton's a guy who hadn't really been stealing much, but he, before his injury, he'd been running more. And I think it's, he should be back soon. But yeah, the closers, I didn't Puck.
You didn't plan it like this, right?
I can't say I thought they'd all have jobs, and I thought Sewald would split, but I thought the Mariners were in a position where they'll probably win. They'll be competitive and win close games with a really good starting group and some issues on offense. And Puck, I thought, had a good chance to close out games in that uncertain bullpen, and I liked his underlying skills. Again, if he could stay healthy, and I love Lang's talent in Detroit. Didn't know if they'd win many games, but I didn't want to invest early in closers this year. I did that last year, and I know a lot of smart players like the certainty, but I just want to try to pick up saves later on if I can, or in FAB. Those were some, and then again, players aren't linear. So I know we both are big Josh Lowe guys this year, and super talented guy, great speed power combo. What if he can trim his strikeout rate? What if he does? And he's in the best system to teach skill in baseball, arguably. So that's Nolan Gorman, another guy. I think this is the year the post hype guys came back in a big way, and. I've also missed guys like Yandy. I had him last year. I really liked. He's a useful player, even if he didn't have this power spike. Still, a really useful guy to accumulate, have a good average. But why? I just kind of gave up on the idea that he can change. And all of a sudden, in year nine of his career, he changes. And when everyone's been screaming at him to lift his launch angle for, first 8 years of his career, whatever it is, and like fifth year in Tampa, smartest baseball people. Why is it year five? And is it simple? Is it the comfort of knowing he has that multi-year contract where he's willing to explore more? I don't know. I'd like to actually ask him about that. But he's one of the guys I really regret because I've always liked him as a solid player. And I was upset when Cleveland traded him in the Jake Bowers deal way back. He's a great on-base guy. So that was some of the process and how I arrived at this, team that's doing pretty well through the first third plus of the season. And some of it's probably just luck, but I did try to have more of a process and more of have a board, bring in optionality, try to be balanced in that to that end and shoot for some upside plays late because we really have no idea who's going to take the leap. And I sort of like max exit velocity because we don't know who's working with a swing coach. We don't know who's really hungry to take next step, but it speaks to some underlying elite level skill that perhaps they can tap into, sort of like Nathaniel Lowe last year. I don't have him this year, but he was a guy who tapped into something last year and improved. So that's sort of how I arrived at at this group. Knock on wood.
No, it's great. It's great. I mean,
I just jinxed it with this whole conversation.
No, yeah, no. The good thing is, some might tell you friends that I have that effect, but no. Usually, this team has good structure. By the way, the thing you said about the optionality and the rabbits, it's funny how much we have evolved as a fantasy community. Where if you recall, I remember, I think it was kind of in the early days of Twitter, or at least when I started using it, it would be like, oh, I got Malik Smith. I got my stolen bases covered. Or I got Billy Hamilton. And guess what? Little hamstring tweak, second week of the season. And hey, there goes your entire category. And then you have to punt. So, yeah, it, fantasy player, that's just one of the many examples of how much smarter the general population of fantasy players have gotten.
And I've been there. I've done it multiple. I've made the mistake multiple times. It takes me like several times I keep repeating the same mistake before I actually learn from it. I don't know what that is, but maybe Mason Miller is another example of that too this year. I don't know.
Yeah, and Mason Miller was basically your big fab spend, right?
He was. The season so far. Okay. And I was trying to be more. Actually, I had George Kirby last year, who was a really good big dollar ad, and Julian Merriweather the year before, who was a terrible investment. And I wanted to not, I didn't want to get on the 300s on any player, but I did want to take one big early shot on one of these stud young arms coming up. And I want, basically, I was going to bid like 220 range on each of them. So I didn't.
Travis Sochik, you're just like us, you're just like the rest of us. You also want a 200 plus starting pitcher.
Yeah. So by rule, I'm just going to bid the same amount on each one that comes up, and hopefully I get one without going to like 370, because I didn't want to do that. But maybe I should have done that. I should, because Bybee was my favorite of this group that's been up so far, and I'm sort of regretting not just being in the market. I sort of was pretty familiar with him for a long time, and Guardians Twitter. I regret watching the gifts of Mason Miller's like, one start in AAA and like
so
96 mile an hour cutter, and look, I told myself I wouldn't. I'd be a little more disciplined and not go for a small sample size like the Julian Merriweather experience. But there, I did it again. Mm-hmm. It takes me like three times to make the same mistake before I stop doing it. Very frustrating. But your have been like really good. Like I felt using your tools helps keep me within range. And again, I think it's become something of people are using it, definitely. And it's another part of game theory to think of going forward. Like, okay, here's the range. What do I need to do to get some guys?
I always tell myself one season, and again, I'm not trying to hold myself on a pedestal. There's a lot of really great work out there. Yeah, I guess maybe I'm just first and early and I don't know, maybe people like me, whatever. But one year, I just want to put nothing out there. Just like retire from the fantasy industry for one season and just see how I do in NFBC, just kind of on the down low. I don't know if I can, but we'll see. By the way, perfect segue, because I did have one last question for you here. Just a super quick rankings game of three players that you know. And you've been setting these segues up for me perfectly. You had mentioned Tanner Bibee. But I, for example, I have these cut lines that I play. By the time this is published or this podcast is out, cut line bids will have already been completed. So people won't hear this till afterwards. But maybe you can help me personally, because I'm having a little bit of trouble with these three guys. They all happen to be Cleveland Guardians starting pitchers. They all happen to be pretty good. But I really wanted to kind of put you on the spot in your knowledge of your local team expertise and of knowing these three guys. How would you rank Tanner Bibee, Aaron Civale, and Logan Allen for the remainder of the season?
I do have a lot of trust, I think, as we all should, and the Guardians have such a good track record of pitching development, and they generally have avoided catastrophic injury. So I do like this group quite a bit. I would rank it Bibee and Allen, and then probably a teardrop to Civale, just because of his... even though I just went on a rant about how we don't know injury, we assess injury risk that well. I do think his checkered history and just the talent level. I think Bibee's the premium velocity and the pretty good command track record at multiple off-speed breaking offerings. I would put him one. But Logan Allen has some of the interesting fastball shape we were talking about earlier, too, and I think he gets a lot out of his stuff. So I think those are both great options. I don't think you could go wrong with either rest of season, but I would go Bybee. One.
Nice. Okay. Yeah, it's a tough one. I think I even have, you know, five cutline teams, and I've been even mixing and matching where I don't necessarily have one guy over the other, and some, and it's just like how you feel at the moment. You're like, okay, now I'm it, and some people are different. Some people are like just very, you know, into it, but there's just something I'll dig into a little bit more on Savali. I'm like, man, he's really good. If he can just stay healthy. And again, that's the $1 million question. If they can just stay healthy, but yeah, it's a nice staff. And then, wouldn't be nice, man. It'd be nice to see Tristan McKenzie kind of help lead you there to the promised land. That was quite the start.
Yeah. He looked great. And his, he was healthy despite the build. He had a huge volume last year. He's a great command guy, and his velocity was up in his rehab. And I did stash a lot of guys in this draft just because I've tried to be, I'm trying to use patience as a advantage. And if I can, it takes some roster luck and not having a ton of injuries build up, but if I can wait on Glass now and have some injury luck, if I can wait on McKenzie, who are just sitting there, I didn't feel like I reached for them. I had Matt Chapman and Glasnow in the queue in the draft, and I actually I didn't listen to my board. I actually jumped Glasnow because I had picked.
Nice.
I turned
to adjust. They got strikes again.
Yeah, in part because I drafted like six hitters in a row, or I'd gone very hitter heavy. I think a lot of people would not stash so many players, but I just thought it's a way to get more value out of a pick if you can wait around and not have a huge injury crush. So that's hopefully Tristan, he looked great. Hopefully he can keep it up because he's got that rare bat missing plus command that we're all looking from our pitchers, and so many injuries too, like these top end guys and underperformance. That would be big for the Guardians and for Mr. Wonderful's chances.
Mr. Wonderful's, yes. And it's funny that you mentioned the stashing, because that's kind of like one of the fantasy rules. It's something that I preach. It's, hey, listen, you know, in the draft, especially the main event, don't stash more than one guy, right? You know, my big one in the main event was Rodon. I'm still waiting on him. But for me, if I, you know, I then swore myself off. I'm like, okay, now I have Rodon. I cannot take Glass now, or I cannot take, you know, McKenzie or whoever it was. So I kind of made that decision and an earlier draft capital. And it's just funny. People might say, okay, let's say, I'll knock on wood for you. Let's say you win the main event overall. People go back, do the case study of your team. Like, wait, he stashed all these guys early on, and then this and that. Maybe it is okay. You can win this way. And my key takeaway from that would be, okay, but now look at the good injury luck on the rest of his team and how things came together. It's never just like one answer. It is, you know, it worked out not in because of, but in spite of, right?
Yeah. I mean, I find the case studies interesting. Like, I mean, I wrote one on Phil, so I found it, you know, that was really interesting. I tried to learn things from it, but there's more than one way to win in any season. And you can make a lot of mistakes in season and still have a great season too. So, and learn in season. So, the stashing, I was also trying to look at, is the waiver wire is my bench, and saying, okay, you're not going to find these players available in June. And if they are, they're going to be $350 in fab. So I don't really want to do that. Let's try to use the bench. The waiver wire is your bench to some degree. And so far it's been okay, because I've had okay injury luck in season outside of, you know, O'Neill Cruz and DeGrom, which is hurting. Yeah, we'll see. I think it's interesting, the whole stash game. I know I went against industry consensus, and I could just be a fool who's having some luck in year three with this. I don't know. But I do like hunting upside, and one of the easiest ways to do it is to take, I think, non-premium capital and have them return and pitch to their play to their talent level rest of the season.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I really like the team, and I really liked our time together, and we're kind of wrapping things up here, but this is fun. I mean, these are my favorite type of things to do. I'm realizing that just, you know, spitting off, talking about in, you know, recent injuries and the impacts and things like that. Like, there's just so much more that I'm personally interested in talking about. And these types of conversations to me are really refreshing. And obviously I'm learning a lot from it as my, in having these convos, and I'm assuming the folks that are listening are as well. But Travis, is there anything that you wanted to, you know, anything else you wanted to mention to the fantasy community, or anything you wanted to promote that you work on?
If you're not familiar with the Score app and if you're not interested in what I'm writing, that's fine, but you should check it out for the scores. It's a great box score app. It really is a news app.
I agree.
Check out the Score, and yeah, just really, I love the NFC community, fantasy community at large. I think it's mostly great people from what I've been able to tell on Twitter. There's always a few bad apples out there, but for the most part, great community. It's a lot of fun to be a part of, and yeah, I'm enjoying it. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and be great to do it again sometime, and keep up the great work, because I need it every Sunday night, even if it Fab probably takes up too much of my weekend, but I do appreciate your work, Vlad.
Thank you so much. Yeah, there's something fun. I don't know. There's something. It's a mix of emotions. It's, yeah, the whole Fab process. So I love it, man. I could talk about it all day. Everyone, you can follow Travis at Travis_Sawchick. And thank you so much for coming on today. Greatly appreciate it. Hope everyone enjoyed this podcast. For Travis Sawchick, I'm Vlad Sedler. This is the FTN Fantasy Baseball Podcast, and we'll talk to you next week.